Top of the morning to you, Oregon. I'm Finn J.D. John, FJ at OffbeatOregon.com, your host for today's dollop of the Offbeat Oregon History Podcast. Thanks for downloading. I hope you enjoy it. This story was first published on March 24th of 2019, under the headline, Mayor's Wife Gave Him a Real Election Day Surprise. Here we go. It was around 2 p.m. on Election Day, December of 1916, that Umatilla's mayor, E.E. Starcher, first discovered that he was not running unopposed for re-election. That's when someone mentioned to him that his wife, Laura Starcher, was running a write-in campaign against him. Soon-to-be former mayor Starcher thought this was a fine joke, of course.
I felt secure enough, he told a reporter from the Pendleton East Oregonian, but I got busy at once. Everywhere I went among old adherents, I found they had voted for my wife, and I thought all the time they had voted for me.
By the time the polls closed that evening, he had lost in a landslide 26-8, and the city of Umatilla had elected a full slate of women to all its elected positions. Not a single man was elected, or rather re-elected, since the men they defeated had all thought they had been running unopposed until 5 hours before the polls closed. In addition to Starcher, the voters of Umatilla elected Lola Merrick as city treasurer, Stella Palu, Florence Brownell, Mrs. H.C. Means, and Gladys Spinning as city councilors, and Bertha Cherry as city recorder. Although Umatilla even then was a tiny town, population roughly 200, it was a remarkable coup. Women had just won the right to vote in Oregon in the 1912 election, and were still not allowed to vote in national elections. That wouldn't change until 1920. And of course, the country was being treated to a flood of anti-suffrage propaganda courtesy of business interests, especially the liquor industries, that believed they would suffer if women were able to vote. Typical of this sort of propaganda were quote-unquote joking postcards showing pathetic-looking men in house dresses holding a wailing baby in one arm and scrubbing laundry on the washboard with the other, while a mannish and masterful-looking woman in trousers and waistcoat puffs on a cigar and tells him he missed a spot. Naturally, there were some overtones of this style of joking in newspaper coverage of the event.
Though the women who won the election are still keeping secret their plans, it is said that there is no doubt that the town will have a man as marshal for the simple reason that among the duties of said marshal are care of the city hall, as well as doing the janitor work about the institution, and the women elected propose that no woman shall have to do that menial labor.
A Portland, Oregonian reporter wrote a few days after the election, with an almost audible sneer. This claim is contradicted by every other news report I could find, by the way, including, ironically, another article published on the very same page, under the headline, Umatilla May Have Woman Police, Too. A few days later, Mayor-elect Starcher told the Pendleton East Oregonian she'd reached a definite decision about that. That official will be a woman, she told the reporter. We will not leave the enforcement of our laws to any man, because past experience has proven the laws will not be strictly enforced. The men as yet consider the recent election as a huge joke, she told another newspaper correspondent, but the women are taking this matter seriously. I have not mapped out my career for the future, but our main idea is to put the town government on a good and sound financial basis. The Election Day coup had its origins in a card party held at Treasurer-elect Brownell's house a month or two before. The ladies at the party got to talking about the sad and dwindling state of Umatilla's appearance. It looked, they all agreed, like a town in terminal decline. It was especially bad because a month or two before, the town council had canceled its contract with the power company to provide streetlights, and the city officials seemed uninterested in doing anything about it. The ladies were indulging in the usual desultory musing about how much better things would be if women were in charge when, at some point, one of them tumbled to the fact that thanks to the results of the last major election, they didn't have to just speculate anymore. They drew up a plan on the spot, selected candidates from among themselves, and got busy. Mrs. Brownell's husband, a local railroad executive, was in on the plot, and he undertook to discreetly spread the word among the railroad men, those who could be trusted not to spill the beans. The ladies got busy spreading the word among the wives and daughters of the town at tea parties and social gatherings, and they kept things so quiet that the men who fancied themselves to be in charge of the town knew nothing until election day. When election day came, it was all such a huge surprise and such a clean sweep that headlines were made nationwide. Umatilla's election was dubbed the Petticoat Revolution. Not surprisingly, far-distant journalists, most of whom assumed this was some sort of suffragette stunt, felt free to impose their own dramatic spin on the story. Some didn't stop at spin. An article in the notorious New York Herald testified that, quote,
"Strong men wriggled and flushed under the biting satire of Mrs. Starcher's inaugural address, which was largely devoted to a skillful dissection of mere men's foibles, weaknesses, faults, shortcomings, vices, general uselessness, and worthlessness. But they sat and took their medicine."
And readers of the Herald were free to believe that and to trust that the newspaper had actually gone to the trouble and expense of sending a reporter all the way out to Oregon to cover the mayor's race in a tiny town none of them had ever heard of, even though nobody would ever have been the wiser if they had just stayed in Manhattan and made the story up, which, of course, is exactly what they did. Laura Starcher stepped down as mayor 8 months into her term for health reasons, represented by some reporters as a nervous breakdown from which they imply that the cares of public office drove her to the brink of madness, and was replaced by Stella Paulou, who went on to easily win re-election in 1918. The ladies ran the town for 4 years. From 1916 to 1920, the town had a 4-2 majority of women on the city council and was led by a female mayor. Newspaper reports at the time and thereafter implied that the ladies were in over their heads and barely hung on to power, straggling through the next 4 years without getting much done. But Hartwick College historian Shelley Burtner Wallace, who dug into the city records and courthouse documents, found out that this was not the case at all. In fact, the ladies did an excellent job of turning things around at City Hall. They brought back the streetlights and put water meters on all the residences. They cracked down on public nuisances like dogs and chickens running loose around town, and they took prompt action to put the city's streets and sidewalks back in presentable order. And they sent many a letter to residents of the type that modern homeowners would associate with a fairly aggressive homeowners association. The ladies had launched their campaign because they saw their town looking progressively more and more slummy, and getting the town to look properly respectable was priority one. A homeowner who left some construction material out in the yard too long got a letter from the mayor's office ordering him to, quote, remove the toilet from the yard. Another got a letter ordering him to clean up the shed, and several got notices to clear out trash. Those who ignored such notices quickly learned that the ladies weren't bluffing. Promptly after the deadline named in the letter, city contractors would be on the scene taking care of the problem and the homeowner would be duly billed. To help encourage things to not get to that point, though, they instituted a garbage service paid for by the city. They also founded a library and a fire district. They instituted a speed limit and parking ordinances and installed warning signs at railroad crossings. They drew up plans for a campground for tourists, downtown water fountains, and a pest house. In 1920, the coterie of ladies who had taken over Umatilla and turned it into a respectable and well-groomed hamlet retired from public life. Apparently feeling that their mission had been accomplished, they declined to run for re-election and returned home to enjoy the little piece of heaven they'd helped create, leaving a standard-issue all-male city government to carry on. Key sources in this story included works by Shelley Burtner Wallace, Daryl Jabin, and the archives of the Morning Oregonian and Pendleton East Oregonian from December 1916. That's our show for today. Thanks again for listening. This podcast is part of Offbeat Oregon History, a public history resource for the state we love. More info is at our hub page, offbeatoregon.com. Offbeat Oregon is a division of Pulplit Productions, a boutique publishing house about which more can be learned at pulp-lit.com. Speaking of which, if you enjoy listening to me, you might check out some of my audiobooks. You can find them most easily with a search for my name on audible.com. Most of them are old pulp stuff, H.P. Lovecraft, Edgar Rice Burroughs, etc., but at least two of them are offbeat Oregon history-type titles. Check them out if you're so inclined. Our theme music is by the Atlas String Band and was written by Carmen Ficarra. Listen and download more at atlasstringband.com. Episodes of Offbeat Oregon History are uploaded around 6 a.m. every weekday, so the next one will be on your device and ready to go before you know it. And until then, go out and fill up the rest of the day with good stuff. Bye now.